Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. We have all heard that addiction is a disease, not a moral failing. But without scientific proof, it's sometimes hard to forget. Except maybe when we look at our own compulsive behaviors, our own impulsive actions. What triggered that overwhelming desire to eat ice cream? Why did I buy another black t-shirt? Finally, we're learning more about the cravings that fuel self-defeating habits and how science can help us fight them. Written by Fran Smith, our reading today comes from the September 27 National Geographic. And I'm not sure that I gave you the title for that. It was called The Addicted Brain. Patrick Parati scoffed when his mother told him about a doctor who uses electromagnetic waves to treat drug addiction. "I thought he was a swindler," Parati says. Parati, who is 38 and lives in Genoa, Italy, began snorting cocaine at 17, a rich kid who loved to party. His indulgence gradually turned into a daily habit and then an all-consuming compulsion. He fell in love, had a son, and opened a restaurant. Under the weight of his addiction, his family and business eventually collapsed. He did a three-month stint in rehab and relapsed 36 hours after he left. He spent 8 months in another program, but the day he returned home, he saw his dealer and got high. "I began to use cocaine with rage," he says. "I became paranoid, obsessed, crazy. I could not see any way to stop." When his mother pressed him to call the doctor, Parati gave in. He learned he would just have to sit in a chair like a dentist's and let the doctor, Luigi Galimberti, hold a device near the left side of his head. On the theory, it would suppress his hunger for cocaine. It was either the cliff or Dr. Galimberti, he recalls. Galimberti, a gray-haired, bespectacled psychiatrist and toxicologist who has treated addiction for 30 years, runs a clinic in Padua. His decision to try the technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, stemmed from dramatic advances in the science of addiction and from his frustration with traditional treatments. Medications can help people quit drinking, smoking, or using heroin, but relapse is common, and there's no effective medical remedy for addiction to stimulants like cocaine. It's very, very difficult to treat these patients, he says. More than 200,000 people worldwide die every year from drug overdoses and drug-related illnesses, such as HIV, according to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and far more die from smoking and drinking. More than 1 billion people smoke, and tobacco is implicated in the top 5 causes of death: heart disease, stroke, respiratory infections, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and lung cancer. Nearly 1 of every 20 adults worldwide is addicted to alcohol. No one has yet counted people hooked on gambling and other compulsive activities, gaining recognition as addictions. In the United States, an epidemic of opioid addiction continues to get worse. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a record 33,091 overdose deaths in 2015 from opioids, including prescription painkillers and heroin, 16% more than the previous record set just the year before. In response to the crisis, the first ever U.S. Surgeon General's report on addiction was released in November 2016. It concluded that 21 million Americans have a drug or alcohol addiction, making the disorder more common than cancer. After spending decades probing the brains of drug-loving lab animals and scanning the brains of human volunteers, scientists have developed a detailed picture of how addiction disrupts pathways and processes that underlie desire, habit formation, pleasure, learning, emotional regulation, and cognition. Addiction causes hundreds of changes in brain anatomy, chemistry, and cell-to-cell signaling, including in the gaps between neurons called synapses, which are the molecular machinery for learning. By taking advantage of the brain's marvelous plasticity, addiction remolds neural circuits to assign supreme value to cocaine or heroin or gin at the expense of other interests such as health, work, family, or life itself. In a sense, addiction is a pathological form of learning, says Antonella Bonci, a neurologist at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Galimberti was fascinated when he read a newspaper article about experiments by Bonci and his colleagues at NIDA and the University of California, San Francisco. They had measured electrical activity in neurons in cocaine-seeking rats and discovered that a region of the brain involved in inhibiting behavior was abnormally quiet. Using optogenetics, which combines fiber optics and genetic engineering to manipulate animal brains with once unimaginable speed and precision, the researchers activated these listless cells in the rats. Their interest in cocaine basically vanished, Bonci says. The researchers suggested that stimulating the region of the human brain responsible for inhibiting behavior in the prefrontal cortex might quell an addict's insatiable urge to get high. Galimberti thought TMS might offer a practical way to do that. Our brains run on electrical impulses that zip among neurons with every thought and movement. Brain stimulation, which has been used for years to treat depression and migraines, taps that circuitry. The device is nothing but a coiled wire inside a wand. When electric current runs through it, the wand creates a magnetic pulse that alters electrical activity in the brain. Galimberti thought repeated pulses might activate drug-damaged neural pathways like a reboot on a frozen computer. He and his partner, neurocognitive psychologist Alberto Terraneo, teamed up with Bonci to test the technique. They recruited a group of cocaine addicts. 16 underwent 1 month of brain stimulation, while 13 received standard care, including medication for anxiety and depression. By the end of the trial, 11 people in the stimulation group, but only 3 in the other group, were drug-free. The investigators published their findings in the January 2016 issue of the journal European Neuropsychopharmacology. That prompted a flurry of publicity, which drew hundreds of cocaine users to the clinic. Parati came in edgy and agitated. After his first session, he says, he felt calm. Soon he lost the desire for cocaine. It was still gone 6 months later. It has been a complete change, he says. I feel a vitality and desire to live that I had not felt for a long time. It will take large placebo-controlled trials to prove that the treatment works and the benefits last. The team plans to conduct further studies, and researchers around the world are testing brain stimulation to help people stop smoking, drinking, gambling, binge eating, and misusing opioids. It's so promising, Bonci says. Patients tell me cocaine used to be part of who I am. Now it's a distant thing that no longer controls me. The Surgeon General's report reaffirms what the scientific establishment has been saying for years. Addiction is a disease, not a moral failing. It's characterized not necessarily by physical dependence or withdrawal, but by compulsive repetition of an activity despite life-changing consequences. This view has led many scientists to accept the once heretical idea that addiction is possible without drugs. The most recent revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Handbook of American Psychiatry, for the first time recognizes a behavioral addiction, gambling. Some scientists believe that many allures of modern life, junk food shopping, smartphones, are potentially addictive because of their powerful effects on the brain's reward system, the circuitry underlying craving. We are all exquisite reward detectors, says Anna Rose Childress, a clinical neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Studies of Addiction. It's our evolutionary legacy. For years, Childress and other scientists have tried to unravel the mysteries of addiction by studying the reward system. Much of Childress's research involves sliding people addicted to drugs into the tube of an MRI machine, which tracks blood flow in the brain as a way to analyze neural activity. Through complex algorithms and color coding, brain scans are converted into images that pinpoint the circuits that kick into high gear when the brain lusts. Childress, who has flaming red hair and a big laugh, sits at her computer scrolling through a picture gallery of brains, gray ovals with bursts of color as vivid as a Disney movie. "It sounds nerdy, but I could look at these images for hours, and I do," she says. "They are little gifts. To think you can actually visualize a brain state that's so powerful and at the same time so dangerous. It's like reading tea leaves. All we see is spots that the computer turns into fuchsia and purple and green, but what are they trying to tell us?" The reward system, a primitive part of the brain that isn't much different in rats, exists to ensure we seek what we need, and it alerts us to the sights, sounds, and scents that point us there. It operates in the realm of instinct and reflex, built for when survival depended on the ability to obtain food and sex before the competition got to them. But the system can trip us up in a world with 24/7 opportunities to fulfill our desires. Desire depends on a complex cascade of brain actions, but scientists believe that the trigger for this is likely to be a spike in the neurotransmitter dopamine. A chemical messenger that carries signals across synapses, dopamine plays wide-ranging roles in the brain. Most relevant to addiction, the flow of dopamine heightens what scientists call salience, or the motivational pull of a stimulus, cocaine, for instance, or reminders of it, such as a glimpse of white powder. Each drug that's abused affects brain chemistry in a distinct way, but they all send dopamine levels soaring far beyond the natural range. Wolfram Schultz, a University of Cambridge neuroscientist, calls the cells that make dopamine the little devils in our brain. So powerfully does the chemical drive desire. How powerfully? Consider the strange side effect of medications that mimic natural dopamine and are used to treat Parkinson's. The disease destroys dopamine-producing cells, primarily affecting movement. Dopamine replacement drugs relieve the symptoms, but about 14% of Parkinson's patients who take these medications develop addictions to gambling, shopping, pornography, eating, or the medication itself. A report in the journal Movement Disorders describes three patients who became consumed by reckless generosity, hooked on giving cash to strangers and friends they thought needed it. Through learning, the signals or reminder cues for rewards come to provoke surges of dopamine. That's why the aroma of snickerdoodles baking in the oven, the ping of a text alert, or chatter spilling out the open door of a bar can yank a person's attention and trigger craving. Childress has shown that people who are addicted don't have to consciously register a cue for it to arouse their reward system. In a study published in PLOS ONE, she scanned the brains of 22 recovering cocaine addicts, while photos of crack pipes and other drug paraphernalia flashed before their eyes for 33 milliseconds, one-tenth the time it takes to blink. The men didn't consciously see anything, but the images activated the same parts of the reward circuitry that visible drug cues excite. The brain, of course, is more than an organ of reward. It houses evolution's most sophisticated machinery for thinking, considering risks, and controlling runaway desire. Why do craving and habits overpower reason, good intentions, and awareness of the toll of addiction? "There's a strong-ass demon that messes you up," says a burly man with a booming voice who smokes crack regularly. He sits in a black swivel chair in a small, windowless room at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in Manhattan, waiting for his MRI. He's taking part in a study in the lab of Rita Z. Goldstein, a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience, about the role of the brain's executive control center, the prefrontal cortex. While the scanner records his brain activity, he'll view pictures of cocaine with instructions to imagine either the pleasures or the perils that each image evokes. Goldstein and her team are testing whether neurofeedback, which allows people to observe their brains in action, can help addicts take more control over compulsive habits. "I keep thinking, I can't believe I've wasted all that damn money on the drug," the man says as he's led to the MRI machine. "It never balances out what you gain versus what you lose." Goldstein's neuroimaging studies helped expand understanding of the brain's reward system by exploring how addiction is associated with the prefrontal cortex and other cortical regions. Changes in this part of the brain affect judgment, self-control, and other cognitive functions tied to addiction. Reward is important in the beginning of the addiction cycle, but the response to reward is reduced as the disorder continues, she says. People with addiction often persist in using drugs to relieve the misery they feel when they stop. In 2002, working with Nora Volkow, now the director of NIDA, Goldstein published what has become an influential model of addiction called ERISA, or Impaired Response, Inhibition, and Salience Attribution. That's a mouthful of a name for a fairly simple idea. As drug cues gain prominence, the field of attention narrows, like a camera zooming in on one object and pushing everything else out of view. Meanwhile, the brain's ability to control behavior in the face of those cues diminishes. Goldstein has shown that as a group, cocaine addicts have reduced gray matter volume in the prefrontal cortex, a structural deficiency associated with poorer executive function, and they perform differently from people who aren't addicted on psychological tests of memory, attention, decision-making, and the processing of non-drug rewards such as money. They generally perform worse, but not always. It depends on the context. Goldstein's studies don't answer the chicken and egg question. Does addiction cause these impairments, or do brain vulnerabilities due to genetics, trauma, stress, or other factors increase the risk of becoming addicted? But Goldstein's lab has discovered tantalizing evidence that frontal brain regions begin to heal when people stop using drugs. A 2016 study tracked 19 cocaine addicts who had abstained or severely cut back for 6 months. They showed significant increases in gray matter volume in two regions involved in inhibiting behavior and evaluating rewards. Mark Potenza strides through the cavernous Venetian casino in Las Vegas. Electronic games, slot machines, roulette, blackjack, poker, beep and clang and trill. Potenza, an affable and energetic psychiatrist at Yale University and director of the school's program for research on impulsivity and impulse control disorders, hardly seems to notice. "I'm not a gambler," he says, with a slight shrug and a grin. Out of the Pleasure Palazzo, he heads down an escalator and through a long concourse to a sedate meeting room in the Sands Expo Convention Center, where he will present his research on gambling addiction to about 100 scientists and clinicians. The meeting is organized by the National Center for Responsible Gaming, an industry-supported group that has funded gambling research by Potenza and others. It takes place on the eve of the industry's mega convention, the Global Gaming Expo. Potenza stands at the podium, talking about white matter integrity and cortical blood flow in gamblers. Just beyond the room, Expo exhibitors are setting up displays touting innovations engineered to get dopamine flowing in millennials, esports betting, casino games modeled on Xbox, more than 27,000 game manufacturers, designers, and casino operators will attend. Potenza and other scientists pushed the psychiatric establishment to accept the idea of behavioral addiction. In 2013, the American Psychiatric Association moved problem gambling out of a chapter called Impulse Control Not Elsewhere Classified in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and into the chapter called Substance-Related and Addictive Disorders. This was no mere technicality. It breaks the dam for considering other behaviors as addiction, says Judson Brewer, director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. The association considered the matter for more than a decade, while research accumulated on how gambling resembles drug addiction. Insatiable desire, preoccupation, and uncontrollable urges. The fast thrill and the need to keep upping the ante to feel the fireworks. An inability to stop despite promises and resolve. Potenza did some of the first brain imaging studies of gamblers and discovered that they looked similar to scans of drug addicts, with sluggish activity in the parts of the brain responsible for impulse control. Now that the psychiatric establishment accepts the idea that addiction is possible without drugs, researchers are trying to determine what types of behaviors qualify as addictions. Are all pleasurable activities potentially addictive? Or are we medicalizing every habit, from the minute-to-minute glance at email to the late afternoon candy break? In the United States, the DSM now lists internet gaming disorder as a condition worthy of more study, along with chronic debilitating grief and caffeine use disorder. Internet addiction didn't make it. But it makes psychiatrist John Grant's list of addictions. So do compulsive shopping and sex, food addiction, and kleptomania. Anything that's overly rewarding, anything that induces euphoria or is calming can be addictive, says Grant, who runs the Addictive Compulsive and Impulsive Disorders Clinic at the University of Chicago. Whether it will be addictive depends on a person's vulnerability, which is affected by genetics, trauma, and depression, among other factors. We don't all get addicted, he says. Perhaps the most controversial of the new addictions are food and sex. Can a primal desire be addictive? The World Health Organization has recommended including compulsive sex as an impulse control disorder in its next edition of the International Classification of Diseases, due out by 2018. But the American Psychiatric Association rejected compulsive sex for its latest diagnostic manual after serious debate about whether the problem is real. The association didn't consider food addiction. Nicole Levina, a neuroscientist at Mount Sinai St. Luke's Hospital in New York, has shown that rats will keep gobbling sugar if you let them, and they develop tolerance, craving, and withdrawal, just as they do when they get hooked on cocaine. She says high-fat foods and highly processed foods, such as refined flour, may be as problematic as sugar. Avina and researchers at the University of Michigan recently surveyed 384 adults. 92% reported a persistent desire to eat certain foods and repeated unsuccessful attempts to stop, two hallmarks of addiction. The respondents ranked pizza, typically made with a white flour crust and topped with sugar-laden tomato sauce, as the most addictive food, with chips and chocolate tied for second place. Avina has no doubt that food addiction is real. That's a major reason why people struggle with obesity. Science has been more successful in charting what goes awry in the addicted brain than in devising ways to fix it. A few medications can help people overcome certain addictions. For example, naltrexone was developed to treat opioid misuse, but it's also prescribed to help cut down or stop drinking, binge eating, and gambling. Most medications used to treat addiction have been around for years. The latest advances in neuroscience have yet to produce a breakthrough cure. Researchers have tested dozens of compounds, but while many show promise in the lab, results in clinical trials have been mixed at best. Brain stimulation for addiction treatment, an outgrowth of recent neuroscience discoveries, is still experimental. Although 12-step programs, cognitive therapy, and other psychotherapeutic approaches are transformative for many people, they don't work for everyone, and relapse rates are high. In the world of addiction treatment, there are two camps. One believes that a cure lies in fixing the faulty chemistry or wiring of the addicted brain through medication or techniques like TMS, with psychosocial support as an adjunct. The other sees medication as the adjunct, a way to reduce craving and the agony of withdrawal, while allowing people to do the psychological work essential to addiction recovery. Both camps agree on one thing: current treatment falls short. Meanwhile, my patients are suffering, says Brewer, the mindfulness researcher in Massachusetts. Brewer is a student of Buddhist psychology. He's also a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction. He believes the best hope for treating addiction lies in melding modern science and ancient contemplative practice. He's an evangelist for mindfulness, which uses meditation and other techniques to bring awareness to what we're doing and feeling, especially to habits that drive self-defeating behavior. In Buddhist philosophy, craving is viewed as the root of all suffering. The Buddha wasn't talking about heroin or ice cream or some of the other compulsions that bring people to Brewer's groups, but there's growing evidence that mindfulness can counter the dopamine flood of contemporary life. Researchers at the University of Washington showed that a program based on mindfulness was more effective in preventing drug addiction relapse than 12-step programs. In a head-to-head comparison, Brewer showed that mindfulness training was twice as effective as the gold standard behavioral anti-smoking program. Mindfulness trains people to pay attention to cravings without reacting to them. The idea is to ride out the wave of intense desire. Mindfulness also encourages people to notice why they feel pulled to indulge. Nathan Abels has decided to stop drinking several times. In July 2016, he ended up in the emergency room at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, hallucinating after a three-day gin-fueled bender. While undergoing treatment, he volunteered for a TMS study. For Abels, the insights of neuroscience provide a sense of relief. He doesn't feel trapped by biology or stripped of responsibility for his drinking. Instead, he feels less shame. "I forever thought of drinking as a weakness," he says. "There's so much power in understanding it's a disease." He's throwing everything that the medical center offers at his recovery: medication, psychotherapy, support groups, and electromagnetic zaps to the head. "The brain can rebuild itself," he says. That's the most amazing thing. Thank you for tuning into Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.